We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you listening. Young black males in America are in a state of crisis. That is the conclusion of a new report by the Council of the Great City Schools. This is an organization of schools in big cities, as the name of the organization would suggest. It, in fact, is a coalition of 66 of the nation's biggest urban public school systems. It's based in Washington, D.C., and they're interested in promoting urban education. This advocacy group finds that black males perform lower than their peers throughout the country on almost every indicator, and they argue that there has been no concerted national effort to improve their outcomes. This report calls it a national catastrophe. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking about this report, A Call for Change, which you can read if you go to their website. We'll be talking with Michael Casserly. He is the executive director of the Council of the Great City Schools. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can send along your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. As I mentioned, there are 65, 66 members of this organization. A lot of Midwestern school districts belong, just to mention a few, Chicago, Cleveland, Des Moines, Detroit, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, and St. Louis are all members. And we will say hello to our guest this morning, Dr. Michael Casserly. Dr. Casserly, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. The report presents quite a lot of data and tries to make comparisons among various kinds of groups and to parse out this data in various ways. And we can talk about it in some greater detail. But I guess the sort of the bottom line is here is that no matter what sort of comparisons you try to make across a variety of measures, including readiness to learn and how they're doing with reading and math, complete high school, how many go on to some kind of post-secondary education, that compared with just about anybody else that you can compare them with, black boys and young men are behind.
Yes, we did a lot of statistical analysis in this report, and as you indicated, on almost every indicator of well-being, African-American male youth were not doing as well as many other young people across the nation. And it suggested to us that the nation as a whole and schools in general were simply not providing the kinds of support for these young people that they need to succeed.
Now, this is something that's certainly gotten attention before. This, I would think that people
yes.
would hear this and they would look at this report and they would say, sadly enough, I'm sure they would probably say something like, well, that's not really news, is it? Is it?
In some ways, it's really not. This is not the first report that has come out on state of African-American males in the country. As a matter of fact, a recent report by the Schott Foundation that came out a couple of months before ours suggested many of the same kinds of things. I think what was different about the report that we put out was that we did two things that were unique. One was that we tried to put the data that most people know about all in one place and present a more contextual picture of the conditions that many African-American males were being raised in. And two, we did a much more detailed and unique analysis on the reading and math achievement of African-American male students, not only in urban schools across the country, but across the nation as a whole. It was analysis of National Assessment of Educational Progress data, NAEP data, that was particularly unique. So in many ways, this was not a new set of findings, although I think it was probably more comprehensive and more detailed than you see in other places. But we were conscious of the fact that previous calls for action on this front had fallen on many deaf ears for a very long period of time. And when we looked at this data, we came to the conclusion that it was worth ringing the alarm bells one more time to see if we could help galvanize a more convincing set of strategies than had been put into place so far. Mm-hmm. So while in many ways we are joining previous calls for change, we thought we would add our voices and see if we could help marshal some of the talent around the country in a way that hadn't been done before. We were also convinced that urban schools, which enrolled such a large portion of African American students, had a special responsibility to address the issues. So we focused most of our attention there and are going to be convening urban school leaders from across the country to see if we can come up with a more convincing strategy to have urban schools break this cycle of inequity that we see across the country.
Yeah. And I think that while the news here is sobering and discouraging, and I think it's a real challenge for schools, for society. I think that it is the case, though, if you're now looking back over a number of years, there actually has been some small improvement.
There has been, and we were encouraged by the fact that urban schools in particular had made substantial progress with this group of students. Matter of fact, it made substantially more progress than the nation as a whole. And there were some school districts across the country, like New York and Boston and Houston, and maybe Atlanta and Baltimore, if you look carefully at the data, to suggest that there is a considerable amount of work that has been done in places that have actually produced some progress. And it suggested to us that we needed to look more carefully at the work that they had been doing over the last several years to see if we could get a better grip on what the underlying factors were in the progress that they were making. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to note that as sobering as these statistics are, there were it was very clear to us that this is not an intractable problem, despite the fact that public will sometimes suggests that people aren't necessarily all that interested in doing much with it. But it's not an intractable problem. Things can be done to address it. The fact that we haven't very convincingly addressed it so far doesn't mean that it can't be addressed, shouldn't be addressed, or that African-American males weren't capable of meeting the highest academic standards across the country. Mm-hmm. They can, and they do in many cases. And if we provide the opportunities and the resources necessary, more will.
Something, and I realize this is a difficult question because, as you note in the report, it's hard to break the data down this way, that is, to look at black students and then break it down according to gender. Your focus here, though, is on boys and young men.
It is.
Is this primarily a male issue, and to the extent that you can say something about it, are girls doing better?
Well, girls of all races tend to be doing somewhat better academically than boys are, which suggests that that there's been two things. There's been a lot of progress with girls over the last 20 or 30 years or so, and two, that we may have a special set of circumstances with males that need special strategies that we haven't employed so far. I think the data do suggest that there is a set of issues that we need to attend to with our boys. It's also fairly clear that sometimes boys who come from more well-to-do circumstances aren't necessarily doing great either. So there's just a lot of work that needs to be done and a lot more research and a lot more discussion on this issue so we can get a better handle on why these numbers look like they do.
All right. Our guest in this part of Focus, let me introduce again, is Michael Casserly. He's the executive director of the Council of the Great City Schools. This is an organization. It's a coalition of 66 of the nation's biggest urban public school systems. It's been around since 1956. It's located in Washington, D.C. They work to promote urban education through legislation, research, media relations, and so forth. And we're talking about some of what you will find in a recent report, which they issued just came out in October, which they have titled A Call for Change, the Social and Educational Factors Contributing to the Outcomes of Black Males in Urban Schools. And you can read it on their website if you would like. There's a lot of very detailed information there. But basically, the bottom line is that black males, boys and young men, are significantly lagging behind just about everybody else if you take a look at their performance as it's measured by standardized tests, and also look at things like what sort of issues and challenges they come to school with. Do they complete high school? Do they go on to any sort of college? And questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me just ask one other thing, because I think it's one aspect of this that's sure to get attention and also to generate controversy, and that is, if you control for economic status, and that is if you say you compare poor black boys with poor white boys, you see that the white boys do better, and that tends to fly in the face of what we've been saying for so many years, that primarily what we have here is a poverty issue. And if we could deal with that, that should go some way to easing this deficit.
Well, I still think that that is the case. I think the issues of poverty affect these statistics in ways that we don't always understand. And I think some people may have misinterpreted those statistics to suggest that poverty doesn't matter, but all of the research in education suggests that it does. If you look carefully at the poverty statistics in this report, it's pretty clear that African-American young people are far more likely to be raised in households that are poor than other people, other kids across the country. I think the data that suggests that poverty doesn't matter probably needs to be looked at far more carefully, because that data suggests that while poverty may matter, it may not be the only thing that matters, which we would probably agree with, except that I think it's very clear that additional research is needed on these statistics to see whether or not what else is coming to bear. I think it's probably important that we look at preschool education, early childhood opportunities, expectations of kids, the expectations that kids hold of themselves, that families hold of their own kids, and also to look at the opportunities that we are providing these students that may be well beyond issues of poverty. But it is a striking statistic that warrants additional discussion and analysis if we're going to get to the bottom of why these overarching numbers look like they do.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's bring them in to the conversation. Someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just wanted to mention a couple of things. First of all, I think I heard the gentleman say that his research was based on data. And sadly, I do not agree that just data mining is a way to really find out what's going on. Second, I think there needs to be some big assistance for adult males who will then help their own children. Third, there is some data that that African American boys learn differently, and that having the school districts never change their routines, having them focus on standardized testing and practicing for testing, probably is just the worst thing that can be done for the children. And furthermore, just looking at test scores, those test scores are so misleading and so much causing stress in the schools that I'm not sure that they're really helping to take any group of children who need extra work and really help them learn and think. So I would suggest that as this gentleman is working with his schools, that he take a look at how early childhood education is being conducted and how well African-American males are succeeding there, but not on standardized tests, and then look at the ways that African-American males are expected to perform in the classroom, quiet, sit at the desk, answer the questions, drill for the test, and perhaps in that kind of milieu, you'll find some answers and maybe look for some solutions that are less test-driven.
Well, thank you very much. There's a number of points that your caller raised, and let me see if I can address some of them one at a time. One was the issue of data mining and testing. One was an issue related to adults. One was related to differences in learning styles, and one related to early childhood education. All excellent points. On data and testing, we actually agree with the caller that in a lot of ways the education and schooling in America has grown to be test crazy in ways that are counterproductive. What we relied on in terms of in-school achievement data was the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is actually only given in grades 4 and 8 every 2 years, which is the only way that the nation has of gauging its overall academic achievement and progress state by state and over the years. This is probably the best academic achievement data that anybody has any place in the country, and we're confident in its overall integrity. But we do share the caller's concerns about the academic testing that is done across the country. Second, on the issue of adults, we agree that there is probably a set of issues that involve both kids and adults and families and parents and the like. And it's one of the reasons why in calling for a change and calling for a set of conferences, including a White House conference on this, we do think that there is a special role for families and parents and adults, those concerns and issues to be included. Third, on the issue of learning differences and differences in learning styles, I think that is probably right. There's a fair degree of research on this issue, and precious little of it has actually been translated into instructional practices in schools, and we would like to see that change. And then finally, on early childhood, there's also a fair amount of research that indicates that some of these achievement gaps start to evidence themselves by the time that kids are 2 and 3 years old, well before they actually get into school in kindergarten or the first grade. And I think part of the solutions that we need to be talking about more broadly is a much more focused developmental focus in early childhood, how it is we provide it, who has access to it, and the like. I think the statistics that we included in our report indicate that many African-American kids don't have the same access to early childhood education, particularly developmentally based early childhood education, that other kids across the country have. And I suspect that's part of the strategies that we need to be looking at.
Right. Well, I certainly want to thank the caller and invite others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Michael Casserly. He is Executive Director of the Council of the Great City Schools. It's a coalition of 66 of the nation's biggest urban public school systems. It's located in Washington, D.C., and among its members here in the Midwest, just to name a few, Chicago, Cleveland, Des Moines, Detroit, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, St. Louis. They have just recently, at last month, issued a report looking at the performance of young black males in public schools across the country. The title is A Call for Change, and it looks at the fact that across a variety of measures, how they do on tests, but also things like readiness to learn, their completion of high school, their going on to college, that black males do significantly worse than just about anybody else. And it's been a persistent problem now, and it's something that they think certainly is worth attention and conversation. That's what we're trying to do here. Again, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just, I have another caller here I want to get to, but let me ask you another question, because it seems as I look at this that as you're making your comparison, you make comparisons between students at the fourth grade level and at the eighth grade level. And something is happening across that time. It seems that not only are they lagging behind other students, but over time they're losing ground. That is, the kids in the eighth grade are doing less well than they had been in the fourth grade. And here we're talking about averages. So there, I'm sure that there are some, for some, that the spread is even more. What's happening across those four additional grades that now students, by the time they get to eighth grade, have even lost ground?
Yeah, it's we noticed that pattern as well. And as I indicated in response to your first caller, it was pretty clear to us that that this divide appears to open up even before the kids ever get to school. Mm-hmm. And by the time they're in the fourth grade, the gaps are pretty wide. And by the eighth grade, they've become really quite substantial, and in a way where by the time they get to the high school years, kids are starting to make decisions to drop out of school entirely. There's a pretty extensive amount of research that has emerged over the last several years that seems to suggest that at the heart of this problem is overall reading and literacy skills that seem to emerge early in school and become much more pronounced in the middle and late elementary grades that deal with issues of comprehension and overall understanding and mastery of what it is the students are reading. And it's very clear to us that schools are probably doing a pretty good job in early kind of decoding and deciphering skills, but that the schools, including the schools that we work with, are not doing the kind of job that's necessary to develop the comprehension and understanding skills in reading and literacy that our students really need in order to be successful later on. I should say, in summary here, that this particular report and the research that we did gives us no great comfort as an urban school coalition, and we were troubled, and our own members are troubled with the patterns that are emerging from these data. And in many ways, they suggested to us that schools in general, not only urban schools, but schools everywhere, are not providing the value that they need to in order to break some of these inequities that you see in the larger society. In many ways, education is designed, or is supposed to be, at least rhetorically, to ticket out for kids, and the foundation on which they succeed in the society. But in too many instances, it was pretty clear from this data that schools in too many instances were simply reflecting and maybe perpetuating the inequities that we saw in the larger society. And that's why ultimately we decided to go ahead and publish this to see if we could galvanize action in the school community and beyond that would help break this cycle.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other people here. Go to Terre Haute in Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, yes. Thanks for taking my call. 2 years ago, there was a program on that you guys featured, and the woman was a fascinating speaker, and one of the things she talked about was the disparity between the relationship between teachers, their gender, and their ethnic relationship, and the disparity between and how that equated to college graduation and college attendance. In other words, how boys were being poorly fit or poorly served by women teachers, and women teachers being the primary elementary level teachers. In other words, there wasn't a lot of African American men in the elementary system, or even Caucasian men. And I wonder if your guest could speak to how that affects the whole situation. Thank you.
All right.
I think thank you to the caller for your question. I think it's a terrific one, and an issue that we need to attend to much more aggressively. There is, I think, without a doubt, a lack of male teachers of all races in our schools, and I don't want, through my response here, to suggest that the problem is female teachers. The problem is not female teachers. They do a terrific job and work hard every day to work with the students. We do, at the same time, need more male teachers to serve as mentors and role models and the like. And in addition to not having as many male teachers as we should, we certainly do not have as many African-American male teachers, particularly in our elementary grades, that we need. And it does speak to the issue about whether or not we are being aggressive enough in recruiting African-American male teachers and providing enough incentives to them in order for our black male students to be successful in schools. I think one of the statistics that we saw in the report, I don't have it in front of me right at the moment, but I think only some 3% or so of African American male college graduates end up selecting education as a career, which is far too few to provide the kind of backup and mentoring and resources that that your caller is suggesting. Mm-hmm. So, and part of that may be because so many students didn't have a positive experience in school themselves. So I think there's important work to be done in this field, and the data, at least preliminarily, suggests that we've got to be much more aggressive about recruiting and retaining and supporting male and particularly African-American male teachers in our schools. The other part of your caller's question that was at least implicit in his comments was that in too many instances, our African-American students are not being taught by our best and brightest teachers generally, male or female. And I think the data are very clear that in too many instances, our poor students or our African-American and our Hispanic students are often taught by our rookie teachers, who are often very committed and smart and energetic and the like, but too often they are our students are not getting the resources that they need and the skills and talents of our best and most seasoned teachers.
All right. Well, we have several other callers. We'll go right to the next, and this would be Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is, having taught for a long time, that kindergartners could have made, a kindergarten teacher, a good one, could have made the predictions of who were going to be not doing well in fourth grade and not doing well in thinking about dropping out in after eighth grade. And my contention that is because of early childhood education, which many people think of as school, but then many other people think of as home. And I guess I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. Thanks. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a terrific point. As your caller indicated, a lot of kindergarten teachers could probably predict, unfortunately, who was going to be successful academically in school and who was not. This is kind of an interesting situation in the sense that, as I indicated, in a lot of cases, these gaps are already starting to open up by the time students reach the kindergarten level. So in some ways, the foundations are already laid by the time the kindergarten teacher ever sees the kids. At the same time, the flip side of this coin is that sometimes that also sets in motion a set of expectations for kids that simply get played out as the kid moves through the school years. And it gets sometimes played out in ways that are to the detriment of the kids themselves. Your caller mentioned issues of home and family, and I think the data are also very clear here that home and family and parents play a very important role in this set of issues. And I think while there's considerable research on this, we still need to understand much more carefully about what it is that we could do as schools and as a society to help support families as they are working with their kids and building the language skills that they need to be successful in school later on.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to come back to this point, but I have another caller here. I don't want to make them wait. We'll go to Urbana line one. Hello.
Hello. If I were a high school teacher, I would poll my students on what they're interested in. On several occasions, I'd take them to the library, the big book section with lots of pictures, and get them interested in something or whatever they express an interest in and look through. And then if you can increase their interest, you'll increase their motivation, because if their motivation is zero or low, they're not going to do much. Secondly, teachers, there's probably not an audit, just as there was not in my day, of the teacher's effectiveness. Like, I took 3 years of Latin in high school, and that could have been a really profound experience if we would have studied how the most powerful, militarily powerful country and wealthiest country was overrun and suffered internal decay, which contributed to their disintegration. All we did was translate, though. The teacher was diligent. She was hardworking, but she was just really disoriented. There's a lot more to studying Latin than just translating. That's all we did. We never studied their customs, their morals. So that was a failure. The third and last thing, is the curriculum itself. I'm sure a lot of students, like myself, had no interest in math. Yet we had to. I had to take algebra. I had to take plane geometry, and I was. I just scraped by. And I'm sure a lot of students are the same way. They have to take courses like that, or they'll have to take a foreign language they'll never use. Sometimes that's fully appropriate, or advanced mathematics is fully appropriate, but it's not appropriate when the person is not going to use it and he has no interest in it.
Thank you very much for your call. Let me see if I can address your 3 points. One related to what kids were interested in, and the second related to teacher effectiveness, and the third related to curriculum.
Yes.
I think your point about what students are interested in is a factor that too many schools have really overlooked over the years. This issue about student motivation in the work they do and what it is they read is actually far more important than we have given it credence. I rather think that as we are implementing the new Common Core standards that Illinois and other states across the country are adopting, that we're going to have to pay much more attention to issues of motivation and what motivates kids to read much more than we have done so far. It's very clear that student motivation to read, including casual and reading and reading for pleasure, has dipped over the years. And I rather think that if we were to put more materials in front of students that met high expectations and high standards, but provided them with greater motivation, that we would probably see a bit of a dent in this issue about literacy and comprehension that I mentioned earlier. Your second point about teacher effectiveness is also a good one. And I'm not sure that I can necessarily speak to your point about the instruction of Latin, but I can address your issue about teacher effectiveness. And I think many of your callers might be surprised to learn that there is surprisingly little research out there on why some teachers are effective and why some teachers aren't. It's one of the areas where research over the last several years is just getting started, but you might be surprised to know that the amount of good research on why some teachers are effective and other teachers aren't isn't terribly extensive, and a new set of efforts in Tampa, in Memphis, in Pittsburgh, and other cities has just recently been launched to see if we could finally get a handle on this question, and to get a handle on the question about how it is you take teachers that are, say, only moderately effective and make them far more effective over the years. On the issue of curriculum, I think it's very important here that our schools enrich the curriculum that is being taught, and there is some evidence to suggest that the richest and the most effective curriculum isn't always accessible to all of our students, maybe particularly poor kids. So I think there's a lot more work that we need to do, one, to make the curriculum much more effective, to make it richer, to include all of the kind of motivational materials that the caller referenced earlier, to make sure that everybody has access to that curriculum, that the curriculum reflects the highest standards and expectations for all of our kids, and that it's appropriately what they call in the education world differentiated in a way that can address the unique learning styles of all of our kids.
We just have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less. I want to thank the caller and also introduce the guest once again for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10 minutes or more. Michael Casserly is the executive director of the Council of the Great City Schools. This is a coalition of more than 60 of the nation's biggest urban public school systems. In our area, our part of the country, they include Chicago, also Detroit, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, St. Louis. It's an organization that's been around since 1956 and is interested in promoting urban education. They have put out a report, just came out last month, Call for Change, the Social and Educational Factors Contributing to the Outcomes of Black Males in Urban Schools. And if you'd like to read that, and there's a lot of detailed information there, you can go to their website. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to get back just for a couple of minutes here, at least to the issue of families. And I would expect that as a matter of simple prediction, if you ask this question, well, sort of what factors might predict that an individual would complete high school or would go on to college or complete college? And I'm guessing that someone whose parents had been to college would be more likely to go to college. And if your parents had graduated from high school, you would be more likely to graduate from high school. But having said that, I'm sure that that's a great oversimplification, and it's really a lot more complicated than that. What really do you think, in terms of what happens in the home, really is making the difference?
Well, the issue of family is a complicated one, and you're right, it is kind of multi-layered and complex, but it is important regarding this set of issues and others as well. I think the issue of family is partially related to the overall supports that the family is able to provide, and this in some regards has to do with income and employment. What we noticed from some of the statistics is that a good number of African-American children were being raised in households where neither parent, if both parents were there, neither parent had a full-time year-round job, which spoke to the ability of the parents to provide children with the resources that they needed, with books, with computers, with trips to interesting places that more well-to-do families might be able to provide. Along with that, I think there's a fair amount of research to indicate that Family TV patterns are really quite TV viewing patterns are quite different. Reading patterns are quite different, and the language acquisition, vocabulary usage in homes is sometimes different as well. So by the time the children of poorer families get to school, a lot of times they don't have the vocabulary, the mastery of the number of words that they really need in order to start off school on the right foot and the like. It's a very complicated set of issues, but families are kind of the beginning and end point of this entire discussion and are critical to our ability to address this in a more comprehensive way.
Hmm. To another caller here, this is someone in Urbana. Line one, hello.
Yes, this is a very good discussion. Very, very good. And I'm glad that they're addressing the issue. But I think a lot of times children, when they start school, first of all, if they have, as you said, homes that you mentioned they come from, they deal with a self-esteem issue. These children, when you start school, you first realize everybody around you is different in every way. And when you see that you're different and you see that it's very important how you're different, then it's important for that person who has them most of the time of the day to really set to work on that self-esteem in those children that come from poor areas, not to make them feel excluded, but include them. Support them in the way that they feel about things, because when they get in middle school, it's going to get worse because they're going to deal with adolescence, and that self-esteem issue is right there before them. Society in general doesn't look with regard on poor, and they look down. So it's important to build an esteem in those children, and that one person can make all the difference, and that teacher or a counselor or someone else could make a difference in the lives of those one child, maybe. It would make all the difference in the way they learn, how they want to learn and listen.
I think that's an excellent point, and I have to say I'm very impressed by all of the callers that have called in today and that are probably waiting online. They've been very thoughtful and intelligent remarks and questions. The issue that your last caller raises is an important one, and one that also is overlooked too often, along with issues of motivation in schools, and that is issues of self-esteem. And I know too often in education, particularly maybe over the last several years in particular, that issues of self-esteem have been put on the back burner as a lot of proponents of education would simply argue, well, all you need to do is to teach the kids and self-esteem will follow, or that self-esteem is not worth worrying about at all. But there is a lot of evidence around to suggest that self-esteem is central to this overall set of issues, and that expectations, a child's sense of their self, their sense of their own effectiveness in the world, their confidence in their ability to interact with other children and to be successful in the classroom is critical to these issues, and self-esteem is really central to all of that. So the issues that we've talked about today, including self-esteem and family and resources and curriculum and teacher effectiveness and motivation and home life and disparity in teachers and the presence of more African-American males in our classrooms, are all part of the puzzle that we need to piece together to address these issues in a more holistic and effective fashion than we've done before.
Well, we're here to the point where we have about 2 minutes, and I have a couple of other callers who are not going to be able to take, and my apologies, as we really like to try to include as many people as possible. I do just want to at least give you a minute or so to talk about what it is you, in addition to trying to get conversation going around this, that's really why you released the report, what you think might be done to make some progress here.
Well, we released the report in part to galvanize some intelligent and constructive and respectful conversation about this issue, but our ultimate purpose was not just to spur a dialogue, but to see if we could galvanize some additional action. We did call for a White House conference on this issue, not because we thought that the White House was going to be able to solve all of our problems, but because we thought that the White House might be able to shine a brighter spotlight on some of the issues and might be able to marshal additional brain power and talent to address issues that in ways that hadn't been addressed effectively before. We are in the process through conversations like this and others to piece together a strategy that we might be able to pursue not only in schools but through other organizations both at the national and local level to address these issues. So we're going to be piecing together something of a national strategic plan to deal with the success of schools in with African-American males over the next several months, convening more conversations and conferences and meeting with organizations throughout the country to see if we could better coordinate their work and see if we could make what is now a very splintered conversation and a very disjointed set of actions much more coordinated and focused on the issues that we've been talking about.
All right. Our guest, Dr. Michael Casserly, is Executive Director of the Council of the Great City Schools. It is based in Washington, D.C. And if you're interested in reading this report that we have talked about, A Call for Change, Social and Educational Factors Contributing to the Outcomes of Black Males in Urban Schools, you can go to their website, which is www.cgcs.org. CGCS, that's for Council of Great City Schools, .org, or you can just put Council of the Great City Schools in your browser, and I'm sure that you can find it and take a look at the report. And to you, Dr. Casserly, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you to your callers.